What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump has called a Middle East peace plan the ultimate deal. So why is he knowingly putting it at risk? And dozens of women over decades in power. How Harvey Weinstein's complicity machine allowed it to happen. It's Wednesday, December 6th. So it was March of 2016, and candidate Donald Trump was making his first appearance at the AIPAC annual meeting in Washington. Mark Landler is a White House reporter for The Times. This is the largest pro-Israel lobbying group in America.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
It's a place that politicians and political hopefuls go to lay out their credentials for being a friend of Israel.
I speak to you today as a lifelong supporter and true friend of Israel.
And during his speech, Trump said the following thing. He said,
"We will move the American embassy to the eternal capital of the Jewish people, Jerusalem."
And at the time, I remember thinking, yeah, fat chance. Politicians, particularly Republicans, have long campaigned on this promise. And when they get into office, they typically realize there are a whole host of reasons they can't deliver on it, and it quietly dies. It happened that way under President George W. Bush. So frankly, I took note of it. I didn't put a great deal of stock in it until this week.
Mr. Trump called leaders around the Middle East today to tell them he is considering moving the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and recognizing the holy city as Israel's capital.
The State Department is warning U.S. diplomats and their families to avoid Jerusalem's old city. There are fears of violence after President Trump told Arab and Muslim leaders he has every intention of recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and later moving the embassy there.
Mark, what's the significance of where the embassy should be located? It's actually very simple. Embassies are located in capitals. That's true all around the world, and Israel is in a tiny category of having an embassy that is not in the capital. And the reason for that is that Jerusalem is essentially a city divided. You've got West Jerusalem, which is the capital or the de facto capital of Israel, where all the government ministries lie, the prime minister's office, the Knesset. And then you've got East Jerusalem, which has mostly Arab-Palestinian neighborhoods and really functions as a separate city. And a city which, because of its symbolic and historic role, is one that the Palestinians aspire to be the capital of their future state. So this is an eternally contested city, and the United States' position has been,
we are not going to prejudge the outcome of those negotiations, including the final status of Jerusalem.
We don't want to prejudge the outcome of the dispute over Jerusalem's status, so we're going to keep our embassy in Tel Aviv.
The question, and I think there's a lot of people out there who are interested in hearing a real answer and not saying, and not trying to duck and say that this has got to be resolved by negotiations between the two sides.
What is
the capital of Israel?
Our policy with regard to Jerusalem is it has to be solved through negotiations. That's all I have to say on this issue. Our embassy, as you know, is located in Tel Aviv.
So does that mean that you regard Tel Aviv as the capital of Israel?
The issue on Jerusalem has been
Mark, how far back does that controversy go? What's the history of this fight over where the capital of Israel actually is?
Back in 1917, the British controlled Palestine, and they promised the Jews a homeland here.
Well, it really goes all the way back to the founding of the State of Israel in 1948.
The United Nations stepped in with a plan. The United Nations suggested partition. The Palestinians would keep land here, here, and here, and the Jews would have the rest. Jerusalem would be an open city shared by everyone. The Jews accepted the plan, and in 1948, they declared their independence as the State of Israel. But the Palestinians and the neighboring Arab countries rejected partition. War followed, and the borders changed once more.
But the issue became much more fraught, much more divisive in the aftermath of the Six-Day War in 1967.
War in the Middle East. Israeli forces drive spearheads across the Sinai Peninsula, west to the Suez Canal, south to the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, breaking the blockade, capturing the west bank of the Jordan River, and occupying the old city of Jerusalem.
When the Israeli army rolled in and occupied the West Bank, as well as East Jerusalem, which had been historically viewed as Palestinian territory.
Mm-hmm. An astounding military feat, and one that even the Pentagon views with admiration.
And so particularly in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, the international community, the United Nations, and the United States have been, you know, very clear that you're not going to recognize Jerusalem, particularly an undivided Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel.
Ends the war, and it is safe to say that things will never again be the same in the Middle East. This is the situation.
How many countries other than Israel recognize Jerusalem as the nation's capital?
Virtually none. And indeed, not recognizing Jerusalem has been an international consensus until now.
So now that President Trump has done this, has said that the U.S. will move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and effectively recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, how does that fit into a plan to create a Middle East peace plan?
White House officials are saying this is a contentious issue that President Trump is simply taking off the table.
Hmm.
And the argument they're making is that by shaking up the status quo, he might actually hasten the process of reaching an agreement. And in fact, this kind of mechanical question of moving the American embassy is a distraction and a political liability for him at home. And by removing it, by saying, okay, that's settled, I'm going to move the embassy, he can actually make the process less cumbersome and clearer. And I think almost anyone who's worked on the peace process over the last several decades will tell you that putting the status of Jerusalem in question this way and forcing the Palestinians and the Arab world to deal with a new altered reality actually creates more obstacles to a peace deal rather than removing them. The one way that the United States has been able to entice the Palestinians to come to the negotiating table with the Israelis and stay at the negotiating table is by telling them, we are not prejudging the outcome. We're not prejudging the outcome on borders, on what the shape of your state will look like. We're not prejudging the outcome on security arrangements. And we're not prejudging the outcome on the city that you both want as your capital. Once you start prejudging those outcomes, the Palestinians and their Arab supporters no longer have faith in the process. They feel that, in a sense, it's cooked already and tipped against them. And that gives them what they always look for in this situation, which is an excuse for staying away. You want to remove excuses and really force the Palestinians to sit down. This gives them a ready-made excuse to stay away.
So to your point, this seems like an incredibly fraught situation into which the United States has just thrown a wrench. The U.S. recognizing Jerusalem as the capital when every other country in the region doesn't just reject that notion, but rejects Israel's existence in the first place.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that that's why what you've seen in the last 12 hours in particular, as the likelihood of this seem more and more apparent, everybody from the king of Saudi Arabia to the king of Jordan to General Sisi in Egypt to officials in Turkey, to Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, all unite in coming out against this and suggesting and indeed warning President Trump that this is exactly the kind of action that's going to undercut the very thing he has set as a major foreign policy goal.
So If our allies and pretty much everyone else is opposed to this decision by the Trump administration to move the embassy and to symbolically recognize Jerusalem as the capital, and if everyone seems to agree that it makes our goal of a Middle East peace deal, which has been sought by generations of American presidents, harder to achieve, who is President Trump doing this for?
Well, I think that goes back to the speech he gave to AIPAC in March of 2016.
But when the United States stands with Israel, the chances of peace really rise and rises exponentially. That's what will happen when Donald Trump is president of the United States.
President Trump was appealing to two very specific and important constituencies. The first are evangelicals, who, for historic reasons having to do with the prophets and biblical texts, believe that Jerusalem, as the capital of a Jewish state, is an important spiritual message.
And we will send a clear signal that there is no daylight between America and our most reliable ally, the state of Israel.
Andy was also appealing to pro-Israel backers, and particularly Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino magnate, for whom the status of Jerusalem has also been a core issue. Remember, Sheldon Adelson is a major donor and has been a major donor to Donald Trump. And so he, in a sense, made a promise to both of these groups. They both came through for him in a big way in the presidential campaign.
I love Israel. I love Israel. I've been with Israel.
There are all sorts of very good political reasons that have very little to do with international politics.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray, and that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at The New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to The New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Back now with new fallout from the firestorm gripping Hollywood. Movie mogul Harvey Weinstein taking a leave of absence from his own company after reports of multiple sexual harassment complaints against him.
Now police in New York and the UK both launching investigations into allegations of sexual assault.
Several in the 2 months since my colleagues Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey first reported on allegations of sexual assault by Harvey Weinstein, dozens and dozens of women have come forward with their stories about the Hollywood producer.
Two more women have now come forward.
And five more made similar claims in London. More than 60 women have accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual misconduct.
The notion of an open secret, the scale of the allegations, and the decades they spanned have raised another question.
Why, though, did it take so long for all of this to come forward after decades worth of allegations?
I mean, I am genuinely shocked that you can get away with this. I don't know how you could for so long, but clearly...
It's an open secret in Hollywood. How did he get away with it for so long?
Jody and Megan, you've turned your focus in recent weeks to how this could have happened and who else was involved. What have you found?
So what we found is that Harvey Weinstein, for decades, cultivated powerful relationships with individuals and institutions that ended up serving as instruments or shields for his behavior. Hmm. We looked at his relationship with media organizations that, you know, were supposed to cover him, but in some cases cozied up to him instead. We looked at his relationships inside the company. There were executives and lawyers mm-hmm. that sometimes helped cover it up, in other cases chose to look the other way. There were relationships with those in politics that he used to his advantage. Our reporting really aimed to sort of go deeper on those relationships and see the role that they served as he carried on with his predatory behavior for decades.
I want you to walk us through each of those, but let's start within Weinstein's own company, because so many of these alleged assaults took place within the confines of work. What have you learned in this new reporting about just how unusual it was to work at this company?
Even though it wasn't visible to everybody at the time, Harvey Weinstein was able to kind of engineer both of his companies to facilitate and to cover up his behavior. And that was true at the highest levels, and it was true at the lowest levels. Mm-hmm. Harvey Weinstein had many, many, many assistants over the years. People describe him even having four or five assistants at a time. And some of them are accused of really being on the front lines of what happened. They had to not only arrange encounters with women, but there were versions of this thing called the Bible, which was kind of, you know, the How to Be Harvey Weinstein's Assistant book. There were lots of different versions of it over the years, but some of the Bibles also had these kinds of hints on facilitation. They would say things like, if Mr. Weinstein's wife calls, be a gatekeeper, meaning be polite, but don't give her too much information about where Mr. Weinstein is. Now, eventually, there was something else that was entered into the Bible, which is instructions on how to procure for Harvey Weinstein a certain kind of medication that seems to have played a role in his sexual activities.
And what do you mean by that? What kind of medication?
So he relied, it appears pretty heavily, based on the description of some assistants, on medication that men use for erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. This medication is injected directly into the penis. And assistants had to procure it for him. They had to keep it at their desk sometimes, and they had to deliver it to him. Sometimes they even had to clean up the dispensers.
And if assistants protested any of these highly unusual tasks that you're describing, that very much seemed to facilitate this behavior, what would happen to them?
Well, one of the assistants we talked to, her name is Michelle Franklin. She's from the UK, and she confronted him about, she said she was just really uncomfortable with what she was asked to do. And she was fired shortly thereafter. So the message was, if you want to rise in the film industry, you have to put up with this stuff and you have to do it. And I'm in charge of your fate.
I was 26 years old when I started working at the Weinstein Company.
Lauren O'Connor began working at the Weinstein Company in 2013.
I'd been working as a literary scout, finding literary material to option and adapt for, you know, features or television shows. This was the company that was able to take something as literary and sprawling as, say, The English Patient and turn it into an Oscar winner. I mean, that was the dream.
So in the case of Lauren O'Connor, you know, she was a junior executive at the company. And as she tells it, slowly but surely, she's starting to piece together the puzzle of Weinstein's behavior. And she's very troubled by it.
It became clear to me that many of the meetings that we were asked to schedule were not of a professional nature. At their best, employees were used to set dates. And at their worst, without knowledge, they were used to do something much more terrible.
And her first step is to go to human resources for help. And as she tells it, you know, when she did that, she reported that she was frightened to travel with Harvey Weinstein. And the response was basically, let us know if he hits you or crosses a line physically.
What?
And yeah, so then, and you know, so she
continues raising the bar, saying, unless he hits you, we don't really want to know much about it.
Right. And so she, in 2015, she submits a detailed memo outlining a variety of allegations of sexual harassment and other misconduct by Weinstein, and includes what the response had been earlier when she had gone to HR. And, you know, at that point, human resources stepped aside and the lawyer stepped in.
I became a problem that needed to go away. The irony is I was trying to flag problematic behavior, and instead I became the problem.
The settlements that we uncovered with Weinstein going back to 1990, these are all out-of-court settlements in which lawyers sort of swoop in after a woman comes forward with an allegation, and they quietly strike a legally binding agreement in which the woman receives financial compensation and in exchange is required to never speak of her accusation ever again. This is really getting at the nature of these confidential agreements. It is in many ways impossible to piece together exactly what happened with them behind the scenes, because everybody is legally bound to secrecy.
Okay, I want to switch gears out of the confines of Weinstein's companies. How did he avoid ever being exposed by the media, especially the Hollywood media, the tabloids, which cover him and this industry so closely? If so many people seem to know about this, how did it not come out in the tabloids?
The question of Harvey's relationship with the media is a fascinating one. And it's clear that he held off press scrutiny with a mix of threats and enticements. And when it comes to tabloids, one of the most fascinating relationships was the one that Harvey had with David Pecker, who was the chief executive of America Media Incorporated, which is the parent company to the National Enquirer, where he was known internally as an untouchable FOP, a friend of Pecker, the chief executive. And not only did the National Enquirer not cover Weinstein, but what our colleague Jim Rutenberg was able to discover was that it actually, behind the scenes, helped work to dig up information on Harvey's female accusers and giving it to him. And, you know, when we were doing our final round of fact-checking and seeking comment, American media admitted to that.
Wow. What exactly did they admit to?
They admitted that, yes, they acknowledged that the company occasionally worked to gather information to help Harvey Weinstein because of mutual business interests. And they said, quote, to the extent that AMI provided off-the-record information to Mr. Weinstein about his accusers, it did so at a time when Mr. Weinstein was denying any harassment.
So let's say that another tabloid, maybe one where Weinstein doesn't have a friend running things or a formal business relationship, were to get wind of a story about his behavior. How would Weinstein stop them, perhaps, from publishing?
So Weinstein exploited a longstanding system of favor trading between the press and the movie business. Gossip readers need a steady stream of juicy tidbits, and industry beat reporters need exclusives on the next big deal. And Weinstein, he wanted glowing coverage, and he could provide what they needed and more. And so he was sometimes working with others, including A.J. Benza, a former gossip columnist, who says that he was paid thousands of dollars by Weinstein to basically come up with juicy celebrity gossip that Harvey could deploy in his efforts to kind of keep the tabloids happy and deflect any attention, negative attention on him himself.
Wow. So in a sense, Weinstein is generating his own material to barter with tabloids, with celebrity news publications that might prevent them from publishing something unflattering about him.
That's exactly what he was doing.
So these members of the media explicitly offered Weinstein cover by agreeing to bury these stories or barter their way out of them. But there were others who offered him a different kind of a cover, right?
Well, Harvey Weinstein was a master of leverage. He parlayed his films into relationships in New York and Washington and Los Angeles, and then he parlayed those relationships into even more things. probably his most important and closest relationship with a politician has been with Hillary Clinton.
So I'd rather go with Hillary, who's a, you know, strong, proven leader, and the world's crazy right now. We need that strong hand.
He was in on her career from the very beginning. He played an important role in her Senate campaign, and the relationship only grew from there.
But Harvey's here.
Harvey is supporting
Hillary. And you have raised money as
Hillary
well.
Hillary Clinton, yes, you've raised money.
I have raised money, and I think the
and
whole
thing
about
And it continued both in the 2008 and 2016 presidential campaigns. He was able to raise a lot of money. He was able to bring celebrity firepower.
Clinton pulled in something in the neighborhood of $1.8 million. That alone is more than the $1.3 million that Donald Trump campaign reported having on hand.
And then in the 2016 campaign, the writer and creator and actor, Lena Dunham, gave what she says was a pretty strong warning to the Clinton campaign. She said she went to Christina Shockey, who is the deputy communications director, and also one other aide a few months later, and she said that she said things in no uncertain terms. She even used the word rapist.
Wow.
To describe Harvey Weinstein. And so we tried to figure out what happened after that, whether it was ever run up the flagpole. What we can definitely tell you is that Harvey Weinstein not only stayed involved in Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential bid until the very end, but they stayed close until after the election. They had dinner shortly thereafter. And also, one thing we were kind of startled to find out is that just a few days before we broke the Harvey Weinstein story, we found evidence that Harvey Weinstein and Hillary Clinton were still working on a TV show project together. And we found that the project was only really canceled after the allegations came out.
So despite warnings by people who had the Clintons' interest at heart, Weinstein's relationship with Hillary Clinton, or and perhaps his sway or a combination of those two things, was such that the campaign maintained close ties to him, even as people were telling Hillary Clinton's political operation, stay away from him.
That's correct. And by the way, one way of understanding how deep these ties go is knowing that back when President Clinton was facing legal trouble for his treatment of Monica Lewinsky, Harvey Weinstein donated $10,000, which was the legal maximum, to the former president's legal defense fund.
So Harvey Weinstein helped Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, weather his own allegations of sexual misconduct.
Yes.
I was just sick. I was shocked. I was appalled. You know, like so many people who have come forward and spoken out, this was a different side of a person who I and many others had known in the past.
Would you have called him a friend?
Yes, I probably would have.
So a Clinton spokesman gave us a statement, and he said, "We were shocked when we learned what he'd done. It's despicable behavior, and the women that have come forward have shown enormous courage." They said that the staff would not have forgotten the kind of warning that Lena Dunham gave. And then curiously, they said, I want to read you this sentence because it's kind of interesting. They said, "Only she," meaning Lena Dunham, "can answer why she would tell them instead of those who could stop him."
So what you're describing, it's hard to see this as anything other than a man strategically creating an ecosystem designed to allow him to sexually assault and continue to sexually assault women for decades.
That's certainly what it looks like when we piece things together in retrospect. You know, the thing we really want to emphasize about this whole story, Michael, is that we're not putting the emphasis on any one or two individuals. We really felt that what we were writing was a story of collective failure. How could so many different people at so many levels either miss signals or fail to ask questions or fail to speak up or fail to heed warnings? Why did people fail to act? It's very easy to look back at the Harvey Weinstein story and and say, of course, more people should have intervened, more people should have acted. This was a massive collective failure involving many, many, many people. But in the course of reporting the story, I thought that some of the most fascinating conversations we had with sources were conversations in which they asked themselves, well, what exactly should I have done? How could I have stopped this?
Jody and Megan, thank you both for making time.
Thanks for having us.
Here's what else you need to know today.
So please allow me to summarize these decisions. The Russian Olympic Committee is suspended with immediate effect.
After an extensive investigation, the International Olympic Committee is barring Russia from competing in the 2018 Winter Olympics as punishment for a government-backed program of systematically doping its athletes. Among its findings, the Olympic Committee said that during the 2014 Winter Games, Russia's sports ministry tampered with more than 100 urine samples to conceal top athletes' use of steroids throughout the competition.
Individual clean Russian athletes will be able to participate under strict conditions at the Olympic Winter Games Pyeongchang 2018.
Athletes from Russia who receive special permission to compete will do so as independent athletes wearing a neutral uniform, and the official record books will show that Russia won zero medals.
These invited athletes will participate, be it in individual or team competitions, under the name Olympic Athlete from Russia, with the acronym OAR. They will compete with the uniform bearing this name and under the Olympic flag. The Olympic anthem will be played in any ceremony.
And
I am retiring today.
On Tuesday, Representative John Conyers of Michigan called into a local radio show in Detroit to announce that he is leaving Congress immediately. Conyers had been facing intense pressure to resign after allegations that he sexually harassed multiple former employees, charges that he continued to deny on Tuesday in announcing his retirement.
Whatever they are not accurate or they're not true.
Conyers was the longest serving member of the House and the longest serving African American in its history. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.